Earn your JD from UNH Franklin Pierce School of Law and join the powerhouse in legal education. Now accepting applications. A top 100 law school ranked 5th for intellectual property law. Apply today at law.unh.edu. The killing of General Soleimani has increased tensions between Iran and the United States. Professor Bashir joins me to discuss the legal implications. This is the UNH Law Podcast. Learn more about the law school and apply by visiting law.unh.edu. Opinions discussed are solely the opinion of the faculty or host and do not constitute legal advice or necessarily represent the official views of the University of New Hampshire. So, Buzz, summarize the situation in the Middle East.
President Trump ordered the assassination of General Soleimani, general in the Iranian army, a state employee, also viewed as a terrorist, and that assassination was successful. The Iranian government then responded with launching a number of missiles, 8 to 10 missiles, I think it was, on attack on a U.S. air base or army base, I think, in Iraq. And that's where things are now. As a part of the after the killing of General Soleimani, when there was talk that Iran was going to respond, President Trump also threatened to, among other places, Iranian cultural sites. Mm-hmm. So those are the conduct and threatened conduct that's been talked about. So interestingly, there is a number of overlapping and complicated legal issues.
And now we unpack a little.
Now we unpack a bit. Number one, apparently President Trump did not notify Congress before he was going to order the assassination of General Soleimani. And there is a pretty good argument to believe that he should have done that under well-established law, and he didn't do that. He notified the Israeli government that we know of. And so that may have been against the law by not notifying them.
Is this because he is an employee of the Iranian military?
Yes, because arguably it's the kind of conduct that some would definitely interpret as an act of war, right? Because he's not
like Baghdadi, where he was strictly ISIS.
Exactly. And it's not like Osama bin Laden, who
right.
was not a part of a government. So it's different in that regard. And it killing the general in another country's army, it wouldn't be unusual to think of that as an act of war. So there's that issue. And does he even have the power to do that? Even if he had notified him, if it's viewed as an act of war, then he has declared war without the authorization of Congress. There were post 9/11 open-ended authorizations given in relation to terrorists. So now we get to that little messy, is he a terrorist or a general?
Right.
Is he a terrorist and a general? Is he just a terrorist? Is he just a general?
Because with him and the Iranian funding model for area regional political gains that they're looking to get, there's a gray area with regards to
yep.
how the Iranian military acts.
Very, very much so. And so if it counts as an act of war, only Congress under our laws can declare war.
Which we haven't done since World War II.
Which we haven't done for quite some time, shall we say. And the interplay with that uncontested proposition never followed, or often not followed, and who General Soleimani is he a terrorist or not, and the failure to notify Congress, even if it isn't an act of war, there's still a responsibility under some laws to notify Congress, or at least the what's called the Gang of Eight, the leaders of Congress and the heads of the Senate and House intelligence agencies, intelligence committees. So that's that slice of it. The big bucket you put it in is the president's war powers.
Right.
And it's a hotly contested area, not formally in court, but it's a messy, messy area with no firm line. So that's that.
We've had many international conflicts since World War II, obviously. Have any of them been initiated in a similar vein to what Trump did against Soleimani? Where it was done without talking to Congress? At least without a direct response.
Without a tweet after the fact.
Exactly. Minor details.
My belief is, and I can't give you an example, that we have had presidents that have ordered the assassination of South American presidents or African countries' presidents without notifying Congress.
It just hasn't been in the tinderbox that is the Middle East.
Right. And it was in a time where there was not as much public information flow.
Mm-hmm.
So that's kind of the war powers piece of it.
Right.
Then under international law, there's the law of armed conflict. It's a well-established body of international law. One question becomes, put aside the domestic consequences of ordering that assassination and engaging that assassination, whether internally for domestic purposes and war powers purposes internally, that counts as an act of war. Does it count as an act of war under international law? And therefore, does the country that is a victim of that act of war get to respond? And if so, what is a proportional response to that? And if that country responds in, let's call it, a proportional way, then the question becomes, what's a proportional response to that proportional response? And so if the assassination of General Soleimani counts as an act of war, then likely Iran is entitled to respond proportionally. In many circumstances, although it may depend on whether, their response is a defensive one or – and that slowly bleeds into the question of whether their response is a proportional to the act of war, the provoking act.
Mm-hmm.
And so the question here would be, does the sending of missiles to the American army base, count as a proportional response, which they would, if it does, they'd be entitled to engage in without violating international law. So then the next question, that's going to depend on General Soleimani's status.
Right.
Again, we go back to, is he, quote unquote, just a terrorist, understanding what I mean by that, that is not a terrorist and a general. He's a terrorist and only a terrorist. If he's an employee of the Iranian government and is a general and is a part of their armed forces, that's much more likely to be viewed as a provocative act, to be viewed as an act of war, and Iran would be entitled to a response than if he was just viewed as a terrorist.
Now, the fact he was in Iraq when he was killed, does that make it even more of a gray area where he wasn't necessarily within the borders of the country?
Not necessarily, depending on whether he was in Iraq in his status as a general.
Mm-hmm.
So an interesting wrinkle in that, there is some chatter in news sources that he had a conversation with the Iraqi government about a proposed deal that might also involve the United States. And Saudi Arabia in some way was also involved in this and that. And I'm a little hazy on these details. So
I think most people are.
and he attended that meeting or he got a message out of that meeting that he was tasked with bringing back to the Iranian government. And that's what he was doing when he got assassinated.
Interesting.
So if that's the case, it makes him feel much, it makes him, at least as he was operating, even in another country, seem much more like a high government official than it does just a terrorist or only a terrorist.
Because Iran is lobbying pretty hard to be allied with Iraq.
Yep.
And the government of Iraq right now is very friendly towards Iran, is at least the
because
political talk.
Because they are useful in fighting, and the irony of it is Iran is useful to Iraq in fighting ISIS.
Right, because they are not fans of ISIS.
And there was a time, even during the Trump presidency, where there was an informal, indirect, not spoken of alliance with the U.S. forces and the Iraqi forces and assistance from Iran-backed militia is the way, best way to put it. So it's not as if Soleimani's been an unambiguous enemy at every turn forever. The nature of the Middle East is it is a place of shifting alliances, ever-shifting alliances. Remember the abandonment of the Kurds that occurred seemingly long ago now. So there's that issue. And then there's the issue of Trump's threatening to bomb 52 cultural sites in Iran as payback for any response by the Iranian government or military to the assassination of the general. So the Geneva Convention and other documents make it clear that bombing cultural sites, destroying cultural sites, is a war crime. So if the question then becomes, if was this yet another of the president's idle threats, a lot of puffery that, you know, in an effort to intimidate Iran, or was he going to seriously engage in that, depending?
Which is very hard to tell with him because that is his game plan 90% of the time.
That's been his game plan from when he was a real estate developer in New York State. And that's, you know, there's for a long time been the crazy theory of his leadership in the international community. That is, it's good for him to act crazy because it means he's unpredictable. So people are more scared of him. And that's, you know, that may be a part of what's going on. And, you know, that said, on the other hand, there's some people saying already that this is classic President Trump. He creates a crisis, and then now he's looking restrained by not responding to the missile attack, and he can laud himself as a peacemaker and, you know, I'm a restrained person.
Well, at the same time, getting rid of this key player from the—
I solved the crisis that I created myself.
Exactly.
So, you know, there's no— as is typical in the Middle East, there's no firm ground that you can stand on in looking at all these problems and how they play out. And, you know, there's very little mechanism under international law, for example, for taking a country to task for the violation of international law.
Now, say in theory, there was follow through on attacking of holy sites. Strictly, let's think of it in terms of we're not in an active conflict except for these specific bombings.
These kind of tit-for-tat
exactly.
Approach.
Yeah. Now, in that situation, would the Geneva Convention be in effect with this because we're not in an official war?
Yeah, but there's no enforcement mechanism.
Okay.
You've just violated international law.
Okay.
As laid down.
It'd
be condemned by the UN.
Okay. So it may not be immediate hurting of the United States, but there'd be long-term consequences with regards to our status with the United Nations, I'm assuming.
No.
No.
You'd be condemned by the UN and things would go on like they normally do.
Okay.
You know, it would be, we wouldn't be kicked out of the UN. Because they wouldn't have the veto-proof votes to do that. And so what does the condemnation by the UN mean?
Yeah, this brings me back to the migrant crisis with the caravan coming to the border with the issue we had with that.
Yeah.
Same exact thing.
Yeah. And you know, I think it's fair to say that President Trump knows all of this. You know, he doesn't. He certainly is acting like he doesn't really care about international law and being condemned.
There's no punishment for it. I mean, ultimately,
well, in his world, you know, condemnation of the government of the United States by the UN means nothing.
Yeah,
I would wager.
Oh yeah, tell me. He's been outright against the United Nations multiple times.
Right. So there's a lot of law that's involved. You know, it's the kind of stuff we cover in our international criminal law and justice program. International law, the law of armed conflict, but the fundamental problem with international law, save with the International Criminal Court, where, you know, genocide and a couple other things can be a government leader can be prosecuted for genocide, for example. Mm-hmm. But short of that, there are no, you know, countries can engage in sanctions. Well, we've talked in the past about sanctions. Sanctions are really monetary, financial. They're done through the Treasury Department. You know, other countries, but you know, no other country is going to sanction the United States. Okay. I mean, they could, in theory, a European country or Saudi or Middle Eastern company could sanction the United States and put a hold on bank accounts that, you know, President Trump has in those countries. But, you know, that works from the other way around when,
right.
you know, because a lot of people have bank accounts in U.S. banks or bank accounts in other banks with U.S. dollars in it. But, you know, not that many government officials in the United States do.
Yeah, it's extremely hard to sanction the European Union nation, the key European Union nations in the United States. I mean, they're key to the economic flow across the world.
So the only – and I admit that I'm thinking blue-skying right now, but the interesting iteration of that, and I hadn't thought about this before, is the Trump Organization has a lot of loans with Deutsche Bank in Germany. I don't know to what extent Germany has the kind of sanctioning power over banks in their countries that would allow them to affect the status of the Trump Organization's loans with Deutsche Bank.
Interesting point.
Wouldn't that be interesting?
That's super interesting because, right. I mean, we've already had sanctions against leaders in other countries.
Yeah.
We did that with Venezuela.
Yeah, we've done it. We did it with some of the oligarchs in Russia.
Mm-hmm.
We do it sometimes in African countries. So it can be a powerful tool from the U.S. perspective because, you know, people love U.S. dollars.
Mm.
But in reverse, it's kind of not effective because there's no assets to freeze. But I don't know. I have to think through the Deutsche Bank possibility. Isn't that an interesting one?
Thanks for listening to the UNH Law Podcast. Be sure to comment and subscribe to the show on Apple Podcasts, Google Play, or Spotify. See you next Thursday. Join the powerhouse for legal education. Earn your JD, LLM, master's degree, or certificate from a top 100 law school. Residential and online programs available. Now accepting applications at law.unh.edu.